In a time of austerity, a new idea to provide social services.
By tapping into private capital, it relieves the need to be constantly fundraising all the time.
Tapping private investment to provide social services with government only paying when it works. It's social impact bonds, plus a dying art in Italy. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, the Women's Perspective. With federal, state, and local governments cutting funding for social services, many important programs are being pinched or shut down altogether. The Rockefeller Foundation believes social impact bonds may be the answer. Investors pay for services, service providers do their job, and government pays the investors back if and only if the outcome meets expectations. I spoke with Kippy Joseph, Associate Director Innovation at the Rockefeller Foundation, about why social impact bonds might be the right idea at the right time.
The investor gets repaid from the government out of savings that the government has created by addressing the problem in a preventative way.
That sounds convoluted.
It's not the most straightforward. I think the most straightforward way to understand it is government contracts out many of its services that it needs to provide for its citizens. So let's talk about providing support for those who are released from jail and helping them get jobs and stay on the straight and narrow. They provide early childhood education in many cases, but they don't provide it directly. They fund others to do it. This just creates a new funding flow for the service providers. And that way, government only pays back if the services are successful. Typically, what happens is services are paid for upfront, and whether that kid does well in preschool or does not do well, or whether that person who was released from jail reoffends and is reconvicted or does not, it doesn't matter. The money's already gone out the door, and that's taxpayer money. But in this case, government doesn't pay unless they get the successful outcomes, and that's the way that the private investment is supportive of delivering services.
That sounds like a risk for the investor. So what kind of interest is there in an investment like this?
It is a risk for the investor, but investors in some ways are best placed to shoulder that risk rather than a government agency head or commissioner. Investors evaluate risk every day. So we expect that we will see investors who are philanthropically motivated. This will have very low returns, and it is a very risky proposition currently because it's unproven, but it has such great potential for both service delivery and successful impacts, as well as on the return side, that we do think we will start to see both private philanthropically oriented investors, but also some of the more commercial investors who are looking to diversify their portfolios.
Kippy, would this require another level of government simply to oversee these programs and determine their success rate?
It's a great question. Every social impact bond contract or deal will have an evaluation component built into it. So there will be an independent third party that will verify whether the stated outcome is met or not. So there's no way to, the end result is that there's no way to game the system. Whether the metrics have to be simple enough that it is clear for the government and for the service provider, did the number of people who reoffended and were reconvicted exceed the threshold that we're currently at, or was it 10% less, 20% less, what was it? And if it is that 10% less, then that's when the payment will be reached. So the metrics have to be pretty simple, and each of those deals will build that into it.
Is there a model somewhere that's working that we can currently evaluate?
There are two existing social impact bonds that we look to a lot here in the U.S. The first was the original bond in Peterborough, U.K. So in the United Kingdom, where they dreamed this idea up, the prison at Peterborough was releasing men who had been serving short-term sentences and then providing them with services to help them reintegrate and stay out of harm's way, essentially. And those that impact bond has been operating for several years now, and we have some preliminary reports that indicate that we are headed in the right direction. But that is a bond that is existing over several years, so we won't have real outcomes until about year four. And that is the same with most of these. They are longer term than a typical financial transaction might be. Here in the U.S., there is a bond in place in New York City that is focused on the juvenile population that is held at Rikers Island, which is one of our jails here in the city. And that is a, in some ways, it's kind of a notorious place because so many people cycle through that. There is an adult population and a juvenile population, but they're treated equally. And that's not really appropriate for the young people. They need a different intervention. So the social impact bond in New York City is focused on creating a different set of programming for the young people on Rikers Island. And that one is in its very earliest stages, and we don't expect to see any preliminary indications for at least another year and a half.
Are you getting interest from organizations that want to be providers of these services?
Yes, yes. There are three main reasons that the Rockefeller Foundation got engaged in social impact bonds to begin with. And the first was that nonprofit, especially nonprofit service providers that are best in class, even those ones that have been established and have a track record of efficacy with their interventions, still spend much of their time fundraising. And by tapping into this new funding source of private capital, it relieves the need to be constantly fundraising all the time. So that is one of the three main reasons, and that's why so many providers are interested in it. They want to focus on the populations they care about. They want to focus on the improving their services. They don't want to focus on raising the money all the time. But if I may, I'll just tell you the other two reasons that we got involved.
Sure.
The second is that we have heard from many of our government partners, both at the state and the local level, that they are trying to shift towards outcomes-based funding. This is not a new thing. We have pay-for-service or pay-for-performance contracts in many of our government-related assets, including infrastructure, and in some cases in the social services like workforce development. But it's harder and harder to do it with the social services where the metrics are less well-defined, and it's very hard to quantify or monetize those outcomes. So we really wanted to support government in their push towards this kind of commissioning or funding reform. And then the third reason is that here at the foundation, we have a big focus on what we call impact investing. And this is the opportunity to tap into the more than $3 trillion in our capital markets that could be available to address pressing social need with the right kind of financial products or instruments. And the social impact bond is one of those.
In a very partisan, contentious political landscape, it sounds like this is something that could thread the needle for both sides. Do you see it as winning bipartisan support?
It appears that way now. There is a risk that it could get politicized as a concept, but we don't expect that it will because, as you say, on the one hand, it really does focus on enabling government to spend less and save taxpayer money and pay only for the successful provision of services. But on the other hand, it provides more funding for those services that really, you know, these services are desperately needed. And if you talk to any of the vulnerable communities in any of our cities or localities, you will hear nothing but the budget is being cut and we are struggling to continue to provide the level of service that we need. So this really allows for preventative services to be funded rather than operating in a budget cut, let's only fund the most acute need mode. From the point of view of testing the social impact bond as an instrument, we would love to see it applied across a range of problem domains. So we'd love to see it applied to problems in health that we're seeing, like childhood obesity or asthma. We'd love to see it applied in education, early childhood education, or at the community college level, for example. And we are seeing that there is interest across the United States and across issue areas that would make this a reality. But we won't have a critical mass of social impact bonds to really test whether this this instrument is useful for a couple of years now. And I'll just share with you that we support a technical assistance lab for social impact bonds, and that lab held a competition or an application process to invite states and localities to apply for technical assistance and some flexible funding in order to plan for and implement a social impact bond. And we received 28 applications for that technical assistance from across the country and across levels of government, from the smaller towns through to sort of regional groups, including states and governor's offices. So the idea has caught the imagination of our public sector, and it's just a matter of building the capacity to explore it and take it to the next step.
Kippy Joseph is Associate Director Innovation at the Rockefeller Foundation. Coming up, doing the impossible, and a dying art in Italy. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1238. March is officially Women's History Month, and this week we're profiling a woman who believes we should never take impossible for an answer. After being told she wasn't particularly smart, Mary Schultz, a professor of chemistry at Tufts University, set out to prove otherwise.
My name is Mary Schultz. I work at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, Boston. I am a professor of chemistry. The story of my life is if you tell me I can't do it, I do it. And so that's kind of the way it all went. I grew up on a farm. I was the second oldest of seven children. And being a girl on a farm, you're useless. And so I was told, you know, that I could go for education if I wanted, but it wasn't really important and blah, 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 blah. And so having been told that I wasn't particularly smart, I could do whatever I wanted to do. So I decided, okay, if you think I'm not smart, I'm going to do as well as I can. And so I graduated high school valedictorian, which is not bad. And then I was the first person in my family to get a bachelor's degree and the first person in my town to get a PhD. And so that's kind of defines what I do. What if you say something's impossible, that's what I'm going to be doing. I fell in love with science way back when I was probably in second grade or something, and I watched a moth hatch. I can still see that in my mind. And then when I was in high school, I took chemistry as a freshman, which of course you're not supposed to do. You're supposed to do that as a junior. And I found the periodic table, and I thought it was the most wonderful thing ever. And so that really is how I got into chemistry. You know, do whatever it is that makes you excited about the world. That's really the key, because there's so many people who go to work, just earn a paycheck, can't wait till they retire. That's really a sad way to spend your life. So that's the kind of thing, you know, like in classes, students always say, will this be on the exam? It doesn't matter if it's on the exam or not. Do you want to know it? That's what's important. The challenges that women face are, a lot of them are just subtle things that essentially is bound up in this question, you can't do that. You can't be a leader of men because you're a woman and men will resent that. You can't be a physical chemist because you have to drag heavy gas tanks around. There's no reason why physically most of this can't be done by anyone. And an awful lot of things that people think you can't do because you're not strong enough, you can do. You know, the liquid nitrogen tanks are on rollers, and I can pull it as easily as anyone else. And so I think it's that thing, and being told that, sometimes explicitly and other times implicitly by being jumped over for someone else because they're a guy or something like that. One of the incidents I remember when I was a young faculty member at Tufts, and there were seven of us that were junior faculty, and I happened to be the oldest one of them. I was hired first. And we had a meeting with the provost, and the provost said, you know, you older ones should take care of the younger ones. And he was looking at the guys. excluded me from that group of the older, more experienced people because I'm a woman. Well, you know, I sort of stood up and said, I'm here and I'm the oldest one and don't pay attention to me. So I think that's the biggest hurdle you have to go over. It's subtle sometimes and sometimes not so subtle. You know, and what's disappointing to me about the world is that one still has to challenge that. You know, I've been at Tufts for more than 30 years now. You would think that my colleagues would be quite familiar with the fact that women can do whatever. And I still have to remind them, hey, you know, I'm here. I can do this as well as you guys. Any woman can do this as well as you guys. Back off. Don't accept that you can't do it. I just have to reiterate that. I think that's the biggest thing. Don't accept it in yourself. Don't accept it from anyone else.
This story is part of Stories from the Field, a production of the Chemical Heritage Foundation, produced by Mia Lobel. Find out more at chemheritage.org. When my mother was a child, her mother made clothes for all the children in the family. Sewing was a necessary skill. Now, skilled tailoring is a dying art. Many of the best tailors hail from Italy, where the tradition is unraveling due to a lack of training opportunities and the rise of designer fashion. Nancy Greenlease reports from Italy, part of her series Made in Italy for Now.
Vi do la carta che faremo il tight. Farete il tight da soli, eh?
Sebastiano Di Rienzo gives pattern paper to his three students who are in their 20s. He instructs them to sketch, by hand, a pattern for a morning coat. At their age, he was already doing this work for Valentino. Now a globe-trotting tailor, Di Rienzo is dressed on this ordinary workday in a double-breasted jacket with Bordeaux pants that matches glasses. He's a mannequin for the Made in Italy tradition.
L'artigianato italiano ha una cultura di millenni, insomma.
Italian craftsmanship has been around for thousands of years. It's part of our mindset, our culture, this ability to work with your hands that's passed on to us. It's in our blood.
The students are enrolled at the National Academy of Tailors. Pope Gregory XIII founded the school in 1575. Popes and priests, after all, can't buy retail. Even those not in the habit of wearing habits took to visiting academy tailors.
Because at the end, what you buy for nothing gives you nothing. So I hope that in the future people will start to go back to the tailoring shops and start to do the right things for, because the tailoring shops give you what you want.
As tailors say, your body is one of a kind and your tailor knows it. Italian tailors can create a suit that hides that beer belly or a dress that adds a cup size. Academy President Mario Napolitano says after World War II, the streets in Italy were runways, even though the country was poverty-stricken.
Back when everyone still went to the tailor shop, when everyone dressed up Sunday morning, and you would hear about it if you weren't looking good at mass or during the traditional afternoon stroll. It was a different society.
Now Napolitano says everyone wears jeans. He doesn't, though. Napolitano is smartly dressed in a tan check suit, made to measure, of course, sky blue shirt, and not a hair out of place. He says such style is part of Italy's cultural fabric.
L'immagine dell'europeo, no?
This is the image of the European. But unfortunately, we are letting it disappear and we shouldn't. Behind the Italian style, there are vested interests, economic interests. That's why I say that we have to take the lead in teaching tailoring.
The Academy wants to expand to create a 3-year program, but needs funding and the government's approval. Italian tailors, who were once scattered around the globe, sewing suits from Sydney to Rio, are becoming rarer than pedal-operated sewing machines. One of Napolitano's colleagues, who works in New York's fashion district, is always begging him for young tailors trained in Italy.
When he calls me, he always asks me, Mario, don't you have some tailors for me? The workers that he employed were all Italians, but these tailors are all my age. And, well, we need new faces.
One of the few who wants to learn the craft of tailoring is Federico De Peppo of Rome, who is sitting in the pattern-making class.
I was obsessed by Tom Ford, Giorgio Armani. It's always the same classics, but the difference is in the fabrics and in such specific work done on the piece. It was that I wanted to learn.
De Peppo has already designed and made cashmere ties and purses. With a tape measure around his neck, he looks the part of a tailor. Yet, like many others, he has an eye toward another side of the fashion trade.
I don't really want to work as an artisan, you know? My aim is to become the art director.
Napolitano says Italy has reason to be proud of its designers, but tailors have suffered.
The art of tailoring has been neglected. I remember in the 1980s at the Rome fashion shows, the first thing the organizer said was to not criticize the fashion designers. Well, I understand that they were plotting the rise of the fashion designer as an iconic figure, but they shouldn't have done this at the expense of the tailors. But it happened.
Now designers are having difficulty finding capable tailors to sew their fabulous collections. Italy's Artisan Association revealed in a recent study that one in five tailoring jobs goes unfilled, despite record unemployment in the country. Paola Gueli grew up playing hide-and-seek inside her father's tailor shop. Now she has her own store, a few blocks from the Colosseum in Rome. The 49-year-old is lengthening a gray sleeveless dress, adding a feminine, soft pink border. Hunched over the sewing machine, her hands carefully guide the fabric.
Even with a sewing machine, my hands are still necessary. The machine needs my help.
Gueli's personal touch is endangered. Without some adjustments, Gueli says a profession that is part of Italy's heritage will become extinct.
L'Italia perderà grandi mani.
Italy will lose enormous hands. Mine are small, but in the end they're enormous too. Unfortunately, we're not valued. Actually, we are ignored. When I turn to certain groups and unions, even those for artisans, that should help us with loans, assistance, workers, we're not even considered.
Reality slammed home when Gueli had a car accident and injured her right leg, which she uses to control the sewing machine. She searched in vain for someone to step in for her.
I had to close the shop. Well, actually, the truth is I came here anyway every morning, even though I wasn't able to work, to let everyone see that I was still alive. There wasn't anyone that could fill in for me. I'm not saying that I was expecting to find someone of my skills, or a Valentino for goodness sake, but a person that I could trust.
Ecco qua. Anche questo è quasi finito.
Here we go, Gueli says. The dress is almost finished. But the master tailor hopes her craftsmanship doesn't come to an end. A possible savior could be the Tailoring Academy's founder, the Catholic Church. Recently, the Vatican issued a candid letter reminding men of the cloth, from priests to cardinals, to wear appropriate garb in Vatican City. The revived strict dress code could be an answer to the tailor's prayers. I'm Nancy Greenlace in Rome.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.